Everybody, I'm Jerry, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
I get to choose Jason because I asked Jason to speak. I don't know how many years it was ago, but I was at the Lanaman's workshop, and I'm just sitting down. Somebody's talking or about ready to talk, and I just strike up a conversation with this guy next to me. And it's really funny because I'm possibly the unluckiest person when it comes to, like, bingo, raffle, lotto tickets, any of that kind of stuff. If you want to know how to lose, just ask me. I will show you. And I'm talking to Jason, and I think he said he was just back in. I don't think he had a whole lot of time yet. And you know, it's funny. I figured, I looked at my raffle tickets. I had a lot. He didn't have any, and I never win anyway. So I just, here, have some of mine. And sure enough, like, second thing, he went to the whole Joe and Charlie tape set or something like this. And like 6 months later, I'm with another guy who also happened to be named Jason. And I'm telling this new Jason, I said, you wouldn't believe what happened the last time I was here. I said, there was this guy, Jason, that just, man, I don't know what happened to him. And he goes, I'm right behind you. It's like, so this room is 400 people. And we just happen to cross paths, you know, either every 6 months or a year. And I don't think it was by accident. You know, our paths have crossed several times since we've both been sober. And I've seen unbelievable amount of changes in Jason. I got him on Facebook, and so if you don't want to speak, you better unfriend me, because sooner or later I'll get around to, like, stalking you and go, come on, you gotta speak, right? And he's like, sure, I'll speak, whatever. And he was so diligent, and that's how I remember him in our meetings, is that he was here last week just checking out the meeting, which is kind of cool. And I'm really excited to hear him speak. Jason.
Hey guys, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jason.
Hey Jason.
That happened in March of 2006. I'd been fresh out of treatment at the Fulton County Jail for about 2 months. It was a big deal weekend to me. I did a fifth step that weekend that changed everything for me. Anyway, it's good to be here with you guys. Like I said, my name is Jason. I'm an alcoholic. My clean date, my sobriety date is November the 30th, 2005. I have a home group. It's the Thursday night men's meeting at NABA. There's a guy named Paul McKee out there in the metro who sponsors me. I'm nervous up here. I haven't done this in a while. I guess I owe you guys a thanks, those of you in the room today, because you've certainly, I had a pretty decent day today, and it was probably partly due to the fact that knowing I had to come here and do this has caused me to really kind of try to practice the presence of my God today. And it's been a good day as a result of that. Unfortunately, Jerry gave me lots of notice, which means I had a lot of time to think of a lot of things, and I've planned out exactly what you would hear in the next hour, probably 12 to 30 different times, which means that by the time we pulled into the parking lot, I was absolutely bonkers, and right now I have no idea what you're going to hear in the next hour. Oh, jeez. But I believe I probably got some help in this endeavor. Anyway, I want to try and talk about, I love the name of your group. It's obviously a reference to the fifth tradition and the purpose of carrying this message. I was telling Jerry just now, he said, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I'm 48 years old, and I don't have an answer to his question. We're talking about jobs, and it's like, I don't know what I want to do exactly. But I made a very, very conscious decision sometime in my first year of sobriety, because, wow, you'll find out. I'll tell you a little bit about what a mess I was at that point, but I was quite a mess, maybe with 6 months of sobriety, trying to figure out what to do with a life that I'd done everything I could to destroy and to end and to throw away. And I was physically, well, not physically, that's, I'm a bit of a drama queen. It bummed me out that I didn't know what to do with myself. whacked out energy that I'm used to chasing down drugs and alcohol with. What do I do? What am I supposed to do with myself? What am I supposed to do with myself? You have to tell me now. And I didn't have an answer, but I've made a conscious decision to borrow AA's primary purpose and to do what I could at that point to try to carry AA's message. And I, you know, my counselor let me stay out an extra few minutes every night from the halfway house where I lived, and so I was at the 10 p.m. meeting at the Triangle Club every night, seven nights a week, and there were a lot of people in there who apparently were even more bonkers than I was, and AA didn't seem to mind lending its purpose. So when I thought about trying to what to say tonight, I hope that my talk can be about this message and my experience with this message, which goes back quite a ways. It says in the doctor's opinion that the message that can hold people like our attention has to have depth and weight. And in my experience personally, there's two kinds of depth and weight that I have experienced. There's the identification with what you went through when you tell me that you absolutely couldn't get up and go out of your house without a drink, when you tell me that you did these low-down, horrible, unspeakable, sleazy things. And I'm like, wow, I did that too. But there's another kind of depth and weight that's affected me very greatly, and that's the attraction of this thing, that people who I can identify with are living a different way than what they were, and that maybe I can do that too. And when it says attraction rather than promotion, that's a visceral thing. At least if I'm hurting enough, it's very much a visceral thing. I'm like a moth to a light if I really need AA. And if I'm not like a moth to a light, then I'm in danger because I'm in a lot of denial and my ego has come back in. Anyway, I was trying to say all that to say that gonna have to talk about drugs a little bit tonight. I did a lot of them. I just did a lot of them, and it's part of it. And I very much think that my story is an AA story. It's about recovery from alcoholism. It's about recovery from what Dr. Silthworth calls alcoholic addiction. And I think I can probably make it pretty plain to you, at least I hope I can, why all those drugs are part of my AA story. But I don't know none of y'all very well. Maybe there's some people in here who never did anything but drink alcohol, and if that's the case, I would like to say to you, thanks. You saved my life. I can probably refrain from cussing. I can probably do that. You saved my life. And if that doesn't make any sense, keep coming back, maybe it will. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and you are Alcoholics Anonymous for me tonight. And I need, none of this message is anything if I'm not touching base with other members of AA. Anyway, after a 10-minute preamble, I'll start my story. I think am I 47 or 48? I was born in 1967, in November of 1967. I was born in Denver, Colorado. I was born to a couple of idealistic young social workers, who recent college graduates, young people, leftists, starry-eyed liberals, idealists. It was a good way to be born, a good place to be born, nice climate, beautiful times, loving people. It was exciting and it was great. I don't know if you ever, any of y'all have ever attended Al-Anon, but their first step, surprisingly enough, doesn't say anything about how we were powerless over alcoholics, or we were powerless over the people in our lives. It says exactly the same thing our first step says. It says we were powerless over alcohol. And a few of my first memories involved the fact that I was powerless over alcohol. My mom had alcoholism. She had alcoholism for all my whole life, and probably for her whole life, knowing her folks. And I was powerless over it, and it affected me pretty early on. I had a I mean, I remember mostly a pretty, what I think of is, it looks like a happy childhood looking back on it now. I don't know how it was. I mean, that's a lot of distance and there's been a lot of damage, but I know that before I could remember, I think I was two, my folks were divorced, and my mom and I lived alone, and I lived with my mom, I mean, and my mom drank. And alcohol was a part of my life before I realized that it was a part of my life, because it took a lot of my mom's attention, it took a lot of her affection, and it affected our relationship. And it was a pretty important relationship, mine with my mom, the only parent I had. And I learned a lot of, I don't know what all to say about that, learned a lot of a couple of templates about life that have to do with separating off us and what we have and what we do, which is probably secret from the rest of life and the rest of the world out there. And that sort of stuff sinks into a young mind real easily and real quickly without, you know, not doesn't have to be explained. You see it, and you're living it before you even think about it. And whatever, there's a few stories about little car accidents and coming home from school to find the neighbors at the house, you know, telling me, you know, your mom's drunk, blah, blah, blah. Whatever, I don't think any of that is all that dramatic, or even, honestly, the reason I'm not saying more about it is I don't remember it that well. But much earlier, probably, than most people, I was exposed to rooms like this one, because my mom was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. So I think that it's, being as I'm sober and here today, I think it was to my great benefit that I was able to be exposed to alcoholism and to the message of AA pretty darn early. I mean, I didn't know the words in the book, but I saw the effects of the book pretty early. And I went to these rooms where these people, and I didn't enjoy being in these rooms, but I knew that there were rooms where a bunch of people sat around laughing and being way too happy about the fact that they weren't drinking. That knowledge served me well later on, I think. My mom's drinking she couldn't take care of me. I went to live with my dad. My dad's not an alcoholic, and therefore that might have something to do with the fact that we could never relate to one another very well. I don't know, maybe not, but there it is. Sometime while I lived with my dad, I began to experience or display, it depends on who you'd ask. A psychiatrist would say that I began to display certain behaviors. I think that what we call the phenomenon of craving began to sink in, which I didn't experience as restlessness and irritability and restlessness and irritability and discontent sank in, which I didn't experience as, well, I'm restless, I'm discontent. For me, I began to notice that life stinks. And I didn't like a lot of people very much, you know? And my dad's a jerk, and the kids at school aren't very nice, and not only that, but they're stupid, and the stupid ones are getting all the attention and doing better, and the smart ones are just getting pooped on, and whatever. I start noticing all this kind of stuff, which I think a lot of us have noticed over time, and I turn into a pretty angry young teenager. Probably helped me out a lot when I found some of the bands that were around in the early 80s who were very, very good at expressing anger. And punk rock made a big impact on me. And I, you know, my dad got to watch as his kid adorned his room with posters of Charles Manson and Patty Hearst and bands who named themselves after poisons and raid and insect killers and all this stuff. God, I love that stuff. I really did. I think it helped. It helped me a lot, because when I look back on, and I was one of these straight edge kids, you know, because I was strung out on hatred. I was mad. And when those guys said how mad they were and how disgusted they were by all the drunks and the hedonists and the, I said I wouldn't cuss, all the bad people, I felt that disgust, and I felt that anger, and I felt that rage, and they helped me express it for whatever that was worth. I think I probably got hard to live with. My dad was hard to live with. We had a parting of the ways, and I went to live with an aunt who helped me out. That's a long story too, but my aunt became my legal guardian. She lived in Salem, Oregon. I left Denver and went to Salem, Oregon, which was probably very good for me because, like I tell you, it wasn't very peaceful in my head and in my brain. And I learned how to do some things in Salem, Oregon that, again, were probably good and bad, mixed blessings. I learned how to smoke weed and relax and have fun with people. And I learned how to drink beer and get along with people. And that was a great relief, I gotta tell you. I mean, the first time, I don't know about y'all, but I had a couple beers on a couple occasions and they didn't really do much for me. I hadn't drank enough of them too. And I had a couple some hits of weed on several occasions, but they didn't really do much to me until they did. And when they did, it sort of changed everything for me. I just had found a place that I wanted to be and a place that I wanted to stay. And you know, you'll hear a lot of people in AA say, all of a sudden I could talk to all the girls and all of a sudden I could dance. And I never wanted to dance. I just didn't care anymore, and I felt better, and I didn't feel it helped. And I don't think I have to labor that point to you guys. My aunt didn't think it helped that I had learned how to smoke weed. It had been one of the rules that we had when I moved in, that I wasn't going to do anything like that. And I remember very early falling into, again, there's this behavior of like, well, I'm not okay in here, but I'm gonna make it, and I'm lying. I mean, I'm probably only been smoking, I've started using drugs and alcohol maybe 2 months ago, and I'm having this conversation with my aunt. She's like, and I'm like, it's just the hypocrisy in the world and the injustice and the subterfuge and everyone and the school just doesn't get it. And she said, no, it's not, it's pot. And I was really shocked that she knew that she could perceive that. She was in AA at the time, and plus I think I was coughing half the night in the next room, but it hadn't occurred to me that she could put those things together. So I left her when I managed to graduate high school. I moved to Portland, Oregon, and 1986. And I smoked a whole lot of weed, and the weed there was very good, and sometimes I drank, and I had a lot of good friends, and I had a lot of good times, and there was a girlfriend around, and I had these experiences where I wouldn't look out the window when I was supposed to be in college, and I couldn't go to class, and I couldn't go out into the street where everybody was and people were talking to one another, and I couldn't participate in all that, and I just could sit there and smoke this stuff. And I had the experience of getting disgusted with that and throwing it away and then going and getting some more half an hour later because it just wasn't working. Fortunately, not long after that, I met a girl, and so I didn't have to experience that. We went out and did all this stuff and made it okay. And I don't know what all to say about that period of my life. It was really pretty neat. In the way that it often is, I was too busy thinking about how uncool everything was to enjoy how cool everything was, you know? But the girlfriend, who had much more of a colored past than I did, one day she said, after one time she got me to try heroin with her, which I didn't really feel, it didn't really matter to me, but it mattered to her that she had done that to me. And then she said, I'm going away to Minnesota to go to long-term residential treatment. This psychiatrist thinks I have to. And that really affected my life because it screwed with my plans, you know. And she was gone for 1,000 miles away, and I found that I didn't have anything. And I just kept doing what I was doing. And I, after this one very dramatic experience I can tell you about later, where I hit this very dramatic bottom smoking the resins of my bong and thought I saw the devil in there, I found myself at the 10 p.m. Here and Now group of Narcotics Anonymous in downtown Portland, Oregon, which still meets to this day. And I didn't know what was going on, and somebody came up to me and handed me a cup of coffee and said, "It gets better." And I thought, "Oh my God, someone knows." And I can't tell you what anybody said that night, but I think I can give you the message I heard that night. I heard a lot, something kind of like, "But I'm not using today." And someone else said, "But I'm not using today." And I'm telling you, that message hit me really strong, because I didn't know it was possible. I didn't know that you could both feel and be clean. I mean, I guess in the less dramatic way of saying that, I didn't know you could have your emotions and survive them without having to medicate them and drink or drug at them. And those people demonstrated that to me. And I don't know. It was the beginning of 6 years clean and sober for me, which I had been, you know, sober for a good long while, this time in like 2009 or 10. Before I realized, and I was sitting in some meeting, I was listening to someone share, and now that I'm 40 and have a year in Atlanta, and I was like, "God, these damn 19-year-olds with their weed problems up in here, how am I?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, that was me, wasn't it?" Damn kids didn't go out and get as bad as I did, and I'm mad at them for it. Anyway, someone took me across town to an AA meeting while I was there. And it's been my privilege, and it was my privilege at that time, to recognize alcoholism in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it talks in the literature about this too, you know. We have the ability to share our experience in a way that might just trigger something in another person. And they didn't, I think it says somewhere in the 12 and 12 that they didn't know this would happen. Experience gave them the pleasant surprise that someone could actually learn from another alcoholic's experience and not go out and it says something like spared the decades of literal hell that some of us had to go through. That happened to me sitting in the rooms in this one particular group in Portland, Oregon that I felt so comfortable in. This group didn't they didn't hug. They didn't say hi when you told them your name. In fact, they didn't tell you their names. They said, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And then they started talking. They had a group conscious statement on the wall that said, "It's the opinion of this group that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is found in the pages of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Only AA speaks for AA. Unless what you hear in this room can be reconciled with the big book, you may be far better off not hearing it at all." And that I went back after I got sober this time around, and they had scratched, the sheet was still up there, but they had scratched out maybe and written in would be far better not hearing it at all. But that group with those cranky old men and women, I'm really trying not to cuss, those cranky old geezers and battle axes, smoking their cigarettes in there and just talking about this book and reading from this book. And they would read from this book about the book. There was copies of it in every corner of the room. And as if that's not enough, they're reading from it. And as that's every time they open their mouths, and then they're reading from it and they're reading about it. You know, like in the forewords where it says, because this has been the basic text for so many years, there exists a sentiment against any major changes being made in the text. And they're reading the stuff in the book about the book, and it just, strangely enough, it got me into the book. And I got a real grounding in Alcoholics Anonymous that way, and I found my way to a wonderful man who brought me through the steps. And I got to experience what it's like to be free from the bondage of self, through active participation in Alcoholics Anonymous and engagement with the text, the process, and the people. And again, I was too busy to enjoy how awesome that was. It ended up being 6 years before I relapsed. When I had about, I don't know, in 1992, I guess I'd gotten sober on January 26th of 1988. I had 4.5 years, perhaps, when my mom was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. The work I'd done in Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the gift of being able to be present by her side as she died of pancreatic cancer. I had just about 5 years of sobriety, and she had just about 3. After all the years that I had watched her trying and failing and struggling and suffering, we were both sober at that time. And there had been some reconciliation, some amends, some ninth-step work, that some went down then at that point, you know. And I don't remember a lot of that, but I feel a lot of it. I know I remember bits and pieces, and shockingly, stuff has actually begun coming back to me. That happened after I got about 5 years of sobriety, and I started remembering things that I thought I'd just obliterated. When I got sober again in late 2005, and I looked at the state of Jason, you have a lot of time to do that kind of thing in jail. And I looked at what I'd become and what could be done with his mess. There was not a single part of my life that I could examine that wasn't just raging chaos and discord, except my relationship with my mom. It was peaceful there when I thought of that. And it was okay there. That's a gift. It's just awesome. That was a big experience. What happened in the wake of that experience was, well, there was another girlfriend, and she decided to go to pursue studies at the University of Georgia for some reason. She was going to work at the Yerkes Primate Center, and I talked to my sponsor, and he said, "What the hell, man? Go! They got meetings down there too." So I moved to Georgia sometime in '92, I guess, maybe '93, and I had about 5 years of sobriety. And her and I had an apartment in Little Five Points. I had my mom's money, what was left of it. And life was pretty great. I had a job at the Oxford bookstore on Far Road. I was sober. It was a cool ride. The only problem with my ride was that Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in Atlanta, maybe nobody ever told you this, but they suck. Or they did. That wasn't swearing. Was it? I didn't like the meetings in Atlanta. And I don't know what it was. For whatever reason, and I've thought it through, and I'm just sick of thinking it through. For whatever reason, I didn't dig any further than that first impression. And I didn't go to more meetings. I had 5 years of sobriety. I was 24 years old, you know? Over the course of a year, which I didn't drink in for a year in Atlanta without going to any meetings, which to me is a testament to the power of the step work I had done and the fellowship I'd had. Over the course of that year, I think that what happened to me was a really long, I mean, normally when I read this, I'm like, yeah, I want to remember that because I never know when one of those moments is waiting. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. I've had moments where that's absolutely true. Moments where, by golly, I found it necessary to drink. And something has kept me from it. Mostly because I'm hanging around with you guys. But well, I came to Atlanta and I had a year. It wasn't a moment. Over the course of a year, I slowly, in between my ears, morphed from being a drug addict and an alcoholic who doesn't have to drink or drug today into someone who just doesn't do those things. I just didn't drink. I just didn't drug. And I never said, I'm doing that, or I'm better, or I'm fixed. I just thought I didn't do those things. And went on with a whole bunch of other stuff. And there was all kinds of, you know, whatever. Again, I had a record label. I was doing all this stuff. I was involved in a lot of things. I thought it was pretty cool. Probably not as cool as I thought I was, but it was pretty cool. Had a lot of cool friends who were musicians because I had a record label for other reasons. That girl had gone out. Some other girl had come in. I say all that just to say that the kind of house I lived in at that point was the kind where there might be some dope around. We brought it back from a trip to New York for one of the showcases for my record label. And there was like this weird nothing, a romantic snafu. Somebody did something that hurt my feelings. And that morning, and so most of you know this story. That morning I would have passed any lie detector test you'd given me, saying, no, I'm not going to drink today. No, I'm not going to do any drugs today. I don't do that. When I got my feelings hurt that day, I said, give me some of that. And that's how that went. So all that time was gone, and I got to tell you, I made mention of it earlier, this cool fact that like people can learn from other people's experience and people can, you know, things that some of us have had to do can rescue other alcoholics from having to do them, you know. It talks, I think it's in the 12 and 12. Basically, we learn in AA that sometimes a head full of AA and a belly full of booze don't mix. And I think that has saved a lot of lives. If my experience says anything, though, I would like to impart to you that that's not something you might want to bank on. Because for me, as soon as I said, hey, give me some of that, the phenomenon of craving happened. And I didn't really think about y'all for the next 12 years until I went to my next meeting in the Fulton County Jail. I was off, you know, I was back where I had left off. I smoked weed all day, every day. I started learning how to drink in earnest. And from there, a lot of stuff happened. It's funny. I mean, I had learned a lot about the ins and outs of alcoholism, and by the time I took it, I just thought, well, this is what we're doing now. Let's see how it happens. I'm going to do it for real. That's what I thought. I don't know that I was in control at all. I think that booze and dope were at the wheel, is what I think. I and the person I lived with at that point went on an odyssey that took us from little Five Points through a whole bunch of neighborhoods and a whole bunch of apartments and a whole bunch of jobs that I'm not going to get into all that. It culminated, I remember the time I was, this is probably 10 years after I said, give me some of that. And I lost one more job, and the rent was due, was late on our nasty little apartment on Lucille Boulevard in the West End. And I was just taking the bus down to the neighborhood they call the Bluff every day, and I told myself, it made sense that it's stupid to spend this money on rent. I can't afford rent anymore, you know. I don't think I said we're going to be homeless. I said we're moving down there. By the time I got here, I'd been living in a squat in the worst neighborhood in Atlanta for 2 or 3 years, you know. I mean, I don't know. What's the definition of homeless? There's a lot of different people who tell you different things. I never thought I was homeless. We had a nice cat hole, an empty building that we had staked out where we didn't have electricity, we didn't have water, but we had a roof, we didn't pay rent. Like I say, it was a long ways down to that. I think I can get this right. I heard someone, this is the most visceral first step allegory I've ever heard. And I can't remember exactly how it went, but somebody told a story about a man who was suffering from some sort of a bad case, a very bad case of some sort of stomach cancer, and it was looking like there wasn't much hope for him. He went to see his doctor, and his doctor said, "I'm going to schedule you for a surgery." And he said, "Doc, you mean there's something we can do about this? That's great news. We're going to do something about it." And the doctor said, "Well, I got to tell you, we're scheduling this surgery. We're going to go in there, and we're going to cut away some parts of the organs that are still working just to make some more room for this tumor to grow, to try and keep you as comfortable as we can while you're here." And that describes my alcoholic addiction over the course of those years. The job got in the way. It was time to get another one. Having jobs got in the way. It was time to go out and hustle on the day-to-day basis. I couldn't do much straight up hustling. It was time to burglarize a friend's house repeatedly. It was time to, I was not a criminal mastermind, y'all. I remember being in Piedmont Park and I went down there. I was gonna try to turn a trick, but I couldn't seem to figure out how to do that. So I decided I was gonna snatch a purse, and I went up and grabbed this lady's purse, and she wouldn't let go of it. She started screaming, and I ended up running away and crying, and it got worse. You know, friendships got in the way. It was time to cut them out. And I want to tell you, I'm remembering, I don't know who's got what. I know one person I saw pick up 60 days in here. I don't know who else might be where on their AA journey. I called a friend of mine up when I had a year of sobriety, maybe a little bit more, and I said, "Dude, I don't think I'm an alcoholic." He said, "You're crazy. I've heard your story. What are you talking about?" I said, I know I'm a drug addict, man. But I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And shortly after that, the job I had was working in underground at a sports bar, and they told me, you know, to go. I was done with what I was doing. I had to go inventory the liquor supply. And I was confronted with a whole lot of bad memories and good memories and those things that aren't really memories, but it doesn't register here, but it registers here. It's like, oh, there's a bottle of Bombay Sapphire. The Jaeger had a certain bunch of memories. The Sapphire had a certain bunch of memories. The gin, it all triggered things that I realized had been going on with me. And I also was an alcoholic because for a while there, my idea of a higher power was a keg of Newcastle, because it's always there, always flowing, always ready to make things better. But at one point, the nadir or height of my alcohol use in my alcoholic addiction, I was drinking a whole lot right around my 30th birthday, which was a long time before I came in. I had some funny stories. I was on Cops once for coming home and trying to get into the neighbor's house and raising hell when they didn't want to let me in. And the show Cops came and filmed me rolling around with pharmaceuticals falling out of my pockets, cussing at the cops, and I don't know why I didn't go to jail. And that's a good story. Around that time, though, I also woke up to discover, I don't know how many of y'all have experienced blackouts. I'm not nice when I black out. And I know that because I know I'm not nice when I'm about to black out. I've met that guy. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't glad that I checked out before he did his worst stuff, man. I mean, there was a morning when I woke up to discover that I had pretty viciously assaulted someone who I cared a whole lot about. And I bring that up to say this, that in the ensuing years before I got here, as everything else fell away, and all that mattered were pills or dope or you know, and I started using needles and all the rest, and I was turning tricks and everything just disgusting and depressing and degrading that we all do, that you hear about around here sometimes. I didn't leave very many boxes unchecked. But during all of that time, and to me, this for Jason's story, this belongs in there with taking a trip, not taking a trip, switching from scotch to brandy, trying only natural wines. All of that dope and degradation was fine because Jason wasn't drinking any liquor. I was drinking lots of beer and wine when it was, I mean, wine, and you know, Cisco and such when it was around. But I wasn't drinking any liquor because when I drink liquor, people get hurt. And over the course of all this time, what happened is, and I, the man who washed up at Rice Street, that's the Fulton County Jail, over the course of that time, I came to believe something, and I believed that I had tried AA, and it worked for me, and that's why it was too late for me. I believed that it was just plain too late for me. I'd gone too far, and the door was shut on me. I don't know why. I mean, I laugh at that now. I know a lot of guys who believed that these days, but the depth of the sincerity with which I fed that to myself and lapped it up, it's kind of remarkable. I mean, I'm only here because I was too broke to die behind that belief. I didn't have the hustle to scare up a lethal anything. But I believed it with whatever I had. And when I remember being in the jail, I had, at one point in the Fulton County Jail, suffering from withdrawals, they had come to me and said, we have a program called Drug Court. If you sign up for it, you have to do a lot of difficult things, but you can be free within 5 days. And that public defender could have had horns and a pitchfork, and I would have gladly signed whatever she was offering me. And I signed, and I left, and I went back to what I was doing. And it was six or eight months later that they actually locked me up for 4 months. For a good piece of time, and during that time, I knew they were going to throw me back towards drug court. I knew they were going to put me in their little treatment area. I lay there and I said, you know it's too late for you. I know it's too late for you. What's the most I can do if they push me that direction? And the answer came back, I can show up and not lie. Because I just don't know how to express to you the depth to which I didn't have anything left. I hadn't laid eyes on my family for 17 years. I only called them when I was behind bars, because I don't know why. I thought I was a good person, and maybe I was, because I didn't like to call them and ask for money. So I didn't call them at all. I thought that was ethical, and they didn't see me for that long. And I thought, well, I can show up and not lie. And that didn't seem like a very hopeful realization, because I was hopeless. It was too late. As all of you probably can imagine, that's a lot like being fearless and thorough from the very start, you know. And I went there to the godforsaken feeling check behind bars, and I told them I feel incarcerated and miserable. And I feel absolutely hopeless and doomed. And then I started going to the meetings, the NA meetings that they brought in there. They didn't bring in AA meetings. God, did I want a big book as soon as I was trying to do this, but I didn't have one until I was out. And what I discovered about that in my life was that, you see something on PBS about like the desert, right, where it's so arid and desolate that it never rains, like for years at a time. And then once every however many years it rains. And all this stuff that's been waiting blossoms and grows and comes up from the ground. And that is what happened. I mean, the arrogance of the belief that it was too late for me, just astounds me these days. And I don't understand how I didn't die behind that stupid lie. But whatever, I mean, I tried it and it worked. I've got, what, 5-8 more minutes? There's too much to say about the fact that it worked. I sit and listen to stuff about the first three steps in meetings these days, and I'm amazed. I was so desperate when I got sober, so desperate. I ran around doing alcohol. One of my favorite phrases to describe how I was is that no one among us has been able to mainline anything like perfect adherence to these principles. Because if, I'm telling you, man, if I could have just drank or shot or smoked Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have. And I did it like that. I went to every meeting I could find, and I got some, and I followed the voice of the first man who registered with me. And this was Paul McKee, right after I left the jail. I just followed his voice, and I followed the message, and I followed the attraction, and I found myself at a rock, and I've hardly missed any since then. And I just did Alcoholics Anonymous with, what's it say, all the desperation of drowning men. I don't know, drowning men, I've never been there, I don't know how desperate that is, but I did Alcoholics Anonymous with all the desperation of drunks who aren't drinking for a fix, to feel better. And I couldn't tell you there's anything wrong with doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. It's blossomed in my life. And when I think about those first three steps sometimes now, I'm like, I didn't do anything. I just chased the only thing there was. And then I was writing something, and then I was telling it to someone, to a man, and then I was on my knees again. Whatever 6 and 7 is, it came on, it's coming online more and more since then. And things started happening just like it's written in the book. I did that fifth step at the rock. And, you know, the promises in that step about how, you know, we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. We take that quiet hour, and it talks a lot about feelings in those fifth step promises, you know. This has been my, I'm reaching for this because it's been my experience. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the pages which contain the 12 steps. Carefully reading the first 5 proposals, once we're taking this step with holding nothing, we're delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at peace and at ease. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem had disappeared will often come strongly. We feel we are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. I sat there reading these pages in the woods after having done this step, and it was happening as I read it, and I felt like I was on candid GD camera. And I mean, I'm looking around to see if anyone's seeing me, because it was happening just the way it was written. And when, you know, when I got into the amends, it dawned on me one time that these promises are about things that are happening. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will comprehend the word serenity. We will know peace. We will see how our experience can benefit others. We will lose interest in selfish things. Self-seeking will slip away. For me, there's something that happened between those two steps where someone who chased everything away into relief from the feeling of restlessness, irritability, and discontent is able to live based on actions, not feelings. And as a result of that, I do things, and I've done things, and life just happens. 10 has gotten so easy these days. It's so simple. When we're frightened, resentful, selfish, and dishonest, try to fix it. Ask God to remove it and try to fix it. it's gotten very small, step 10, while step 11 has just gotten really big. I heard something yesterday. I'm going to save that for... Step 12 saves my life every day. I don't know what all to say about that because I've wasted too much time. But I can't do this. There's a lot of things I cannot do. And having come through this far, a lot of times this thing rings and there's someone asking me what to do. Or there's someone calling to see how I'm doing today. And I just, my life depends on being in contact with y'all. And these days I don't even have to do that, knock on wood. I mean, I had to show up here tonight. But a lot of times when I really need it, it comes to me. And that's because of step 12. That's because of the work. I wish I'd saved like an hour to talk about my life since then. Up until 6 years ago, I was convinced and I would tell people that the only thing I had done right in my whole entire life was have enough common sense not to breed. And now I'm married and we're pregnant and I'm going to be a dad. Which is amazing. I don't know what to say about that. Really, I don't. Please, have me back in a year so I can tell you what the hell to say about that. I live in this world of joy that I don't even know how to express these days. I was at NABBA last night and someone said something, and this is my 11th step piece for the day. Someone told me about a visit to the chiropractor that he had had. And there was something wrong with his foot, and the chiropractor had a tuning fork and held it to his foot for a while and said, oh, it's not broken. Maybe this is some medicine man juju, or I don't know, but the way they diagnose things is they hold the tuning fork up and the sound will be changed if there's something broken inside. And I get up in the morning and I try to find some time for some quiet time to go back over what I've learned about this stuff and to try to get quiet and listen. And as long as I'm trying to plug into whatever God, whatever it is, and I don't know what the heaven it is, I have not a clue, but if I'm trying to plug into it and I'm broken, that quiet is going to bring it out and it's going to diagnose it. If I want to kill my boss, which I often do, it's going to show up, you know? If I'm sore at somebody, it's going to show up. If I'm split in my head and I'm double-minded about something, it's going to show up. And if I keep sitting there, it seems like I'm able to tune into it in a way that guides me towards fixing that. Follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world. I can't find it. No matter what your present circumstances. That's what it says in there. 8 years ago, I quit smoking. Today, 8 years ago, May 1st, I liberated the suffering workers on May Day in my lungs. 22 years of smoking every single day. And my sponsor told me, take a month, pick a date, go to every meeting you go to and tell them my name's Jason, I'm an alcoholic, and on May 1st, I'm going to quit smoking. I never believed I was going to quit smoking. I just said that for a month and prayed a whole lot and woke up and tried it. And since then, there's been a whole lot of instances of Jason doing stuff that Jason cannot do. You know, God yanks me out of jail and out of the hood and the bluff and cleans me up and sets me down. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. Thanks. I got it from here. But man, when I didn't have to have a cigarette that morning, then I was like, whoa, something's changed. Something's really changed. And whatever it was, it's just, I've done things that Jason cannot do consistently since then. And I owe that to y'all. Wherever it is in there, that's what it says. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world. And if I'm wrong, and you're sober in a year or two, track me down, beat me up. I don't mind. Thanks.